It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll find out what effect dead cattle may be having on wolves in the upper Midwest.
First, we take our weekly look at the top news in national politics, including primary elections in a handful of southern states last night and President Trump's pick for the next head of the Veterans Affairs Department.
In a few minutes, we'll talk about a Democratic campaign strategy unveiled yesterday that will focus on Washington corruption. And we want your take on this at 800-642-1234. Is a pledge to crack down on lobbying and campaign finance abuses important to you? Do you see it as a winning strategy for Democrats to point out what they see as corruption in the Trump administration? Or do you think corruption in Washington is a two-way street? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with those primaries yesterday and Georgia's primary in the race for governor. This got a lot of attention on the Democratic side with Stacey Abrams winning, former state minority leader. She could become the first African-American female governor in the country. Can you talk a little bit about this primary there?
Sure. I mean, she's actually already made history because there's never been an African-American woman who has been a major party's nominee for governor. So it seems pretty incredible that hasn't happened until now, but Abrams is the first one. And so she really excited a lot of progressives around the country. She ran on a progressive platform, and she ran with the notion that her idea was that you don't have to sort of base your candidacy and sort of make your base those sort of more moderate, white, affluent suburban voters in Georgia, and instead that you can focus on, sort of the new majority, as it's known, the progressive white people, Latinos, Asian Americans, Black voters, especially Black women. That's a major part of the strategy. And so she did that without sort of going to the middle or something that angers a lot of progressives. And she ended up, that strategy paid off.
Let's give a listen to Abrams at her victory celebration last night talking about the campaign's approach.
We have to reach out to those who do not believe their voices matter, who've been disappointed again and again by promises made and never kept, who live in counties crushed by poverty and neglect, in suburbs isolated from jobs and opportunity, and sometimes from each other.
And this is a debate around the country, right, Amanda, for Democrats. Do they move to the middle, trying to capture maybe voters who moved to Trump after voting for Obama in the past, or do they try to rally the base, natural Democratic Party supporters?
Yeah, it's been pretty much one of the biggest debates in the party since the 2016 election, I would say. You know, you have a lot of Democrats who say, look, some Democratic voters went to Trump because they feel like the party's not talking to them. And a lot of those voters tend to be white, working class voters, many of them in the Rust Belt areas. Should we focus on them? But there are other people who say, no, look, Democrats lost in part because they weren't paying enough attention to voters of color in cities. Black voters, for example, in Wisconsin, there was a lot of frustration that the Democratic Party didn't do enough in Milwaukee, for example. And so, you know, we need to pay more attention to these voters who are making up this new majority. And we shouldn't be going to the middle. That's not what voters want right now. And so that, in many ways, was tested in this race. And you've been seeing this play out in House races, too, with some progressives getting upset at the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee, which is the committee that helps elect Democrats to the House, that they seem to be meddling. And they're known for often supporting more moderate candidates. And so you're seeing this struggle play out quite a bit.
I want to move to another race now in Kentucky. Amy McGrath, a former Marine fighter pilot, beat the mayor of Lexington in the primary for a House seat there. Why has that one been getting national attention?
Sure. That plays into a little bit of what I was just talking about. Amy McGrath, a first-time candidate. She's a female veteran. She was a fighter pilot, didn't have political experience, and didn't seem to have a shot. Now, the Democratic Party really wanted Mayor Jim Gray. He's the mayor of Lexington, popular mayor there, would have a lot of money. They really wanted him to enter the race. And it seemed like the DCCC was recruiting him and pushing him to get in. And now he did get in and looked like that he was going to be the winner. He was the front runner. But McGrath caught up in part because she had a really good campaign ad that got her national attention, where she talked about her experience as a female veteran. She was standing in front of a plane, I believe. And the DCCC backed off a little bit. Policy-wise, Amy McGrath and Mayor Gray really aren't that different. It was more in their style. McGrath tried to portray herself as this outsider and Gray as this insider, even though, you know, he was a mayor of a city. It's not like he had been in Congress already or something like that. So it was more stylistic differences, but people ended up choosing the political newcomer.
Before we move on from the primaries, I want to touch on a couple of themes some people have been pointing out, one in each party. First, for Democrats, a lot of women running and a lot of women apparently winning primaries. Do you see this as a trend on the Democratic side of things?
Yes, definitely more on the Democratic side than the Republican side. A lot of women running, obviously energized after the election of Donald Trump. You hear from many female candidates that, you know, the ones I've talked to who said, yeah, you know, I decided to get involved after seeing Trump get elected, after being energized by the Women's March, and just thought it was time. So you're seeing, you know, a lot of women run, a lot of women winning, and it'll be interesting to see when all the primaries shake out, actually how many women end up getting the nominations and then how many are able to win and go to Congress. If this is going to be another year of the woman, as we hear so much about, and if there will be a sort of a record number.
And on the Republican side, I've seen some analysts look at a place like Texas, where there were a handful of Republican incumbents not running again, saying, OK, the more conservative backed candidates seem to be doing pretty well in those Republican primaries. Is that something you're watching for around the country?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Republicans, you know, the Republicans are definitely losing more members than you, having more members retire or resign or just say, you know, they're not running again than normal. A lot of those Republicans tend to be more moderates or Republicans who are in slightly tougher districts and just sort of see the writing on the wall. You know, they're in districts maybe that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, and that their district may be a little more purple and changing a bit, and they just figured now, you know, I'm not running for re-election in a year where Donald Trump is the president. I'm going to have to defend everything he says and types of things that aren't popular in my district. And those resignations make it harder for Republicans to keep the seat, because then you have primaries, and a lot of time what happens in the primaries is a more conservative candidate wins. But then that makes it harder to win in the general election for Republicans. And I think, you know, you're seeing some establishment Republicans also sort of getting very worried about that, that they're going to have some of these more extreme candidates that make it harder for them to hold on to the House and the Senate.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Moving away from those primaries now, Amanda, last Friday, President Trump made what sounded like a surprise announcement about his nomination to be the next head of the Department of Veterans Affairs. That would be Robert Wilkie, who's been serving as the interim director. Now, this was unexpected, including to, as I understand it, the nominee himself.
Yes, it was unexpected. I mean, Trump said, you know, I'm making an announcement today. He doesn't even know this yet, but we're going to be nominating Robert Wilkie to be the Secretary of the Veterans Administration. And Robert Wilkie was in the audience. He stood up and went and shook the president's hand. But it's pretty incredible that the president announced it publicly before telling Robert Wilkie that he was going to do this. And you'd think Trump would want to be a little bit more cautious, considering what happened to the previous person he nominated for the job, Ronnie Jackson, the White House doctor, who ended up withdrawing because he wasn't vetted before Trump announced him. It seemed like Trump picked him just basically because he liked him. And all these questions were raised about his former colleagues saying that he had sort of a volatile temper, that he drank while on the job and harassed staffers and all these other things. And so Wilkie seems like he's not going to have those same problems so far, but it was a surprise.
Yeah, with all the trouble at the VA over the years, the problem of the previous nominee, is Wilkie expected to have maybe an easier confirmation process?
Absolutely. He's already gone through the confirmation process for he was previously at the Defense Department, and you are not allowed to serve as the acting secretary of an agency when you're also nominated for the job. So Wilkie has stepped down on as acting secretary of the VA and gone back to his old job at the Defense Department. So, you know, I think a lot of veterans groups I talked to, like the American Legion, also didn't know that he was going to get nominated, although they weren't surprised. And so far, senators have tentatively been saying positive things about Wilkie. You know, they're not committing necessarily to vote for him, but the red flags of Ronny Jackson, it doesn't seem like it's going to be quite as much of a problem.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Huffington Post Washington Bureau Chief, about some of the week's top news in national politics.
After the break, we'll talk about the Democratic Party's plan to make corruption in Washington a midterm campaign issue, and we want your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is the way Washington operates something that's important to you? Do you think the Democrats are in a good place to call out corruption in the Capitol? Will this win over any swing voters? Maybe you are that swing voter. Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, looking at the week in national politics. Amanda, you wrote about this, some leading Democrats in Congress talking about their midterm strategy focused on corruption. They say corruption in the Trump administration, the Republican Party. What kind of things are they talking about?
They are talking about, well, in the Trump administration is things like, I guess the best example is the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. And he has had scandal after scandal, you know, using taxpayer money on expensive things in his office, like a soundproof booth, insisting on extra security because of death threats that don't really seem to be real, things like that. So, I think it's more obvious what they're doing with the Trump administration. But in Congress itself, it's not going to be so much individual scandals of Republican members, although if those come up, I'm sure they'll do them. But it's more things like the tax law. Democrats are going to be stressing that and arguing that, look, it's more of a giveaway to corporations and lobbyists who wanted this rather than helping individual people. And that feeds into this whole culture of corruption and incompetence. And it's not a government for the people. It remains to be seen how much this trickles down into the, you know, the level of, will voters in Wisconsin, for example, in the individual districts, be seeing ads from candidates about this? Or is this more of a Washington talking point? Because I was in Wisconsin a couple of months ago, and honestly, I wasn't hearing a ton of talk about Trump. People were more interested in talking about health care and other issues. So I don't know how this is going to play out, but Democrats say that this is going to be part of their messaging, and they're going to be trying to push policy proposals that address things like protecting the right to vote, campaign finance reform, and other things like that.
And you said there's an analogy here to 2006 when Democrats ran on a similar message and had some success with it.
They did. 2006 was the last time Democrats won back control of both the House and the Senate. And the culture of corruption was a major thing. I've had Republicans who were involved in House races in that cycle tell me that the culture of corruption theme that Democrats hammered was incredibly effective. And one difference was that there were a lot of scandals amongst House Republican members. The one most famous one was Mark Foley, who was inappropriately sending messages to teenage boys. And Republicans fully admit that they had a lot of scandals that year. But you also had, an unpopular president, President Bush, who was under fire for the Iraq War, for his handling of Hurricane Katrina. And that sort of climate helped Democrats as well. And so I think Democrats are hoping that the Trump effect will work similarly in their favor.
And while they're talking about these issues you just mentioned, did they talk about whether they're going to talk about Russia and the Russia probe and the Mueller probe? Are these things that they're not going to have front and center?
They didn't. That is one thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is one thing that they are not talking about as much. I was just at a conference here in Washington the other day where a lot of Democratic senators and other and governors and other public officials spoke. A lot of people who are being talked about as running in 2020. And you never really heard talk of Russia. It just doesn't come up much. Democrats are avoiding it because they are worried that if they run, they're just going to be running as too anti-Trump, and that they feel like that didn't work for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Democrats want to, voters want to hear more about actual solutions. So far you're not hearing a lot about Russia, but that could be changed because there definitely are people in the party who think Democrats need to be talking about it more because it's so central to sort of everything that's going on here.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. Well, we can talk about that probe right now, Amanda. Some of the latest news here, this talk about an informant who had worked for the FBI, talked to members of the Trump campaign during the 2016 election. The president talking and tweeting a lot about this, calling it Spygate. Can you talk about what's out there and how the president is responding?
Sure. So this is someone, the president is claiming Trump's latest theory is that the Obama campaign paid someone to be inside his campaign and to work for his campaign in order to spy on him and help Hillary Clinton. There's absolutely no evidence that that happened. What we do know is that the FBI had a source who was in academia, who assisted them in the Russia investigation. And what he did is he reached out to members of Trump's inner circle, I believe at least three people, and talked to them in what appears to be centered on foreign policy. He never worked for the Trump campaign. He wasn't embedded in the Trump campaign. He was simply reaching out and having meetings to gain more information.
But the president clearly is talking about this. What are people making of what he's saying and how it could impact public perception of the FBI investigation?
Well, the president now and his allies are really, really trying to turn the public against the investigation and against Robert Mueller more specifically, who was very popular when he took the job as special counsel. But even people who have been defending him on the Republican side are feeling like maybe this is going on a little too long. It's now been more than a year since he launched his investigation, or since he took over as special counsel. Trump is trying to make as many people have doubts about Robert Mueller and the investigation. And so that is why you see him tweeting. That is why you see his allies going on air and saying that this is partisan, that Robert Mueller is on a witch hunt. I mean, Robert Mueller is a lifelong Republican, but if you listen to what a lot of Trump allies are saying, it sounds like he is some Democratic plant. Rod Rosenstein, the Justice Department official who oversees Robert Mueller in the investigation, another lifelong Republican. But if you listen to some of the conservative commentary, it sounds like he's a Democrat. So, you know, in short, they're trying to plant as much doubt as possible and turn the public against the investigation because they feel like a lot of this is going to be won in the public sphere.
Want to move on to another story. The summit, the planned summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, scheduled for June 12th, but that's kind of up in the air now. Here's President Trump talking yesterday at the White House.
Well, we're moving along and we'll see what happens. There are certain conditions that we want, and I think we'll get those conditions. And if we don't, we don't have the meeting. And frankly, it has a chance to be a great, great meeting for North Korea and a great meeting for the world.
So where is this planned meeting right now?
I think it's up in the air. It's not 100% clear if it's going to happen. It's still on as of now. But, I think that the Trump administration is getting nervous that they're going to look foolish. I mean, Trump clearly really wants this, and he keeps talking about it, and he keeps basically declaring victory before anything has even happened, which he often does. But North Korea has indicated that, you know, they're not going to just give Trump what he wants, which is unilateral disarmament for absolutely nothing in return from the United States other than basically this meeting. North Korea is saying we're not going to do that, which I think everyone expected North Korea wouldn't go along with that. And so I think Trump and his administration is starting to get a little nervous that they could come out of this looking bad. And so you're hearing now Trump saying, for example, it might not be unilateral disarmament right away. It might happen over time, and he might be okay with that. And they're trying to set expectations now a little bit differently. I mean, you know, you had some Republicans in Congress saying Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for what he's done already. So expectations are incredibly high, maybe a little bit too high. So as of now, the summit's on, but you know, I don't think anyone would be surprised if something happens and it's canceled.
Right. North Korea had objected to planned exercises, military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea, saying that was provocative in the run-up to this. We've got two, I think it's fair to say, unconventional world leaders in President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Is it hard to predict what's going to happen from day to day between these two countries now?
Yes, it is. It's very hard to happen. I mean, I think, you know, some months ago, not many people would predict that there would be a summit planned based on Trump calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and, you know, basically seeming to threaten attacking North Korea. I mean, things were in a pretty dire place. And so to be here now is very surprising to people. But North Korea, you know, often finds excuses for pulling back. Trump is unpredictable as well, as we know, as is Kim Jong-un. So, yes, unpredictability is the main thing here. And so that's why I said if it's canceled, I don't think anyone will be surprised.
And very briefly, Amanda, some news broke this afternoon. I don't know if you've seen it. It's been on the Twitter and all over the place. A judge ruled that President Trump can't block people from following him on Twitter or responding to him on Twitter under First Amendment grounds. Is that one you'd been watching?
I mean, I hadn't been following it closely, but I think that will obviously probably annoy Trump because his Twitter feed is very close to him. But I mean, he is the president of the United States, and if people want to try to talk to him, apparently they're going to get to do it. So it'd be funny to see Trump's reaction as he learns of that ruling.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She was with us for our weekly look at some of the latest stories in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out how dead cattle may be bad news for the ecosystem of the upper Midwest. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can always listen online at WPR.org and follow all of our conversations here on the Ideas Network or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone or tablet. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. When it comes to issues facing farmers in Wisconsin, we often think of wild weather or erratic milk prices. One thing we don't often think about, the disposal of dead animals, more specifically cows.
There are laws and regulations that deal with the disposal of carcasses by burying or rendering, for example, but some farmers choose to dump these cow carcasses, which is not only illegal, but appears to have some other consequences as well.
Our next guest has looked into the effect these carcasses have on wolves in the upper Midwest and how they're behavior is changing as a result.
Tyler Petrulia joins us now. He is a wildlife researcher and doctoral candidate at Mississippi State University. His research was the focus of a recent piece on wiscontext.org titled "Dead Cows Are Changing the Way Wolves Eat." Tyler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So, to be perfectly honest, and I think I can speak for maybe huge segments of our audiences, for our audience, thinking about cow carcasses isn't something I think about a lot. But this is something that you've been thinking about and researching. How did you come up with this topic in the first place?
So, we kind of stumbled across this project as a part of a larger study looking at white-tailed deer fawn survival in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And in doing so, we have a number of collared carnivores, wolves, bobcats, coyotes, and black bear collared. And those collars enable us to track those individuals via 15-minute GPS locations. And so what we're doing is we're going to clusters of these GPS locations because they are potential predation sites. And what we found is that a lot of these wolf cluster sites ended up being at these livestock carcass dumps. So we really started to wonder, well, how does that affect wolf behavior? And also, you know, if wolves are spending a lot of time at these carcass dumps, how does that affect how much they're feeding on white-tailed deer.
So you've been talking about livestock carcass dumps, and we talked a little bit about that in the introduction, but can you break down for us what these dumps are exactly?
Yeah, so a livestock carcass dump, now in Michigan, Wisconsin, they're illegal, and this is an area where a farmer will usually go to the back of his property, you know, a little bit away from his dairy operation, and get rid of a dead cow that is from sick, or, you know, a dead calf, just because it costs a lot of money to get rid of these cattle. They weigh a lot. It's expensive. And also, a lot of farmers don't know that it's illegal to get rid of these cows.
And do you have a sense, I know that part of your data has been looking at these sites, but how common are these carcass dumps throughout either the northern part of Wisconsin or in the Upper Peninsula?
Well, that's a good question. We don't have a lot of data to speak directly to that, but from our study, what we can see is that in an area where there are small dairies, it appears to be fairly pervasive. Now, we were only looking at a couple different counties in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and one of the focus down in Menominee County along Lake Michigan and the Wisconsin border. It's a pretty big dairy land area for that part of Michigan, and we found 9 of these carcass dumps just by following wolves around. That doesn't mean that was all that there were. That just means that's all that we found. But from some of the other current literature, it does suggest that across the Upper Midwest and across the Dairyland, these carcass dumps are fairly pervasive.
Now, we are talking to Tyler Petrulia right now. He is a wildlife researcher and doctoral candidate at Mississippi State University, and he has been studying carcass dumps. These are for cows specifically, and how they've had an impact on the wolf population in the Upper Peninsula. So let's get to the wolves themselves, who have been feasting on these carcasses. I'm going to guess that this isn't a normal thing for wolves to be doing.
Right, exactly. You know, what we'd expect for the natural diet of wolves in this area is primarily white-tailed deer, and then supplemented, you know, by beaver and really any other alternative prey such as grouse or hare, really whatever they can get their hands on. In the summertime, when we were studying their behavior, they're fairly opportunistic. But definitely, we weren't expecting to see that almost 22% of their diet was coming from these livestock carcass dumps.
And, you know, farmers have been taking issue with wolves on their properties. And, you know, you said that they might not be fully aware that these dumps are illegal. But in talking to farmers, you know, what was their reaction to finding out that maybe the wolves on their property was because of something that they were doing?
You know, most of them were fairly receptive to the idea. Most of them were really just curious. Why were we always coming back to their property to look at what these wolves have been doing? And I think a lot of it is just being unaware. You know, 30 years ago, there were not the wolves around for these farmers to have this type of conflict or to be aware of this type of issue. And so I think in general, it's just about getting out there and educating some of these people who are just not aware of the fact that this is an attractant, you know, bringing wolves to their property.
So looking, I guess, bigger picture, this isn't simply wolves on farms or farms attracting wolves, but this could have a ripple effect throughout the entire ecosystem. If wolves are, you know, starting to congregate on these farms, eating these carcasses, what does that do for other prey, either deer, beaver, or for other carnivores?
So that's one of the things that we were kind of most interested in, is what are the ecosystem impacts. And what we saw in, at least in the Menominee County area, is that there's a relatively high coyote population, and the coyotes actually had the highest or greatest predation rate on white-tailed deer with the suite of carnivores. And we were kind of expecting wolves to play a larger role in white-tailed deer predation, at least in that area. So one of those effects is possibly if wolves are being fed, you know, by a supplemental resource like human subsidies, like these livestock carcass dumps, it might open up room for a higher coyote population. So really, that could result in white-tailed deer having to deal with high coyote populations during the summer when their fawns are vulnerable, and then also having a wolf population that is able to be supplemented at a higher population level as well and feed on deer when they're more vulnerable in the wintertime.
So let's say that farmers that are now aware that this is an issue, you know, get rid of these carcass dumps, or, you know, bury them properly, or maybe do take the steps to have these carcasses rendered instead. You know, what then happens to the wolves that might have started to become a little bit more reliant on these dead cows as a food source?
So we're not 100% sure yet. That's one of the big questions that's out there. And obviously you really have an outcome where they could go back to feeding on natural food sources, which is kind of what we'd hope, and restore maybe some of that ecosystem function. Alternatively, depends how habituated these packs are. Does that result in greater depredations on livestock? You know, we're just not sure yet. There has been some work out in Oregon where they've been doing some, you know, removal of wolves and also just removing livestock carcass dumps. And they've seen that by removing the carcass dumps, you know, it can be an effective way of getting wolves to leave the area and go feed back on natural food sources.
So it sort of sounded as though you had a further project moving forward. But what do you hope to do with this research in the future?
Well, ideally, it'd be great to be able to look at areas where we can go in and identify where cow carcass dumps were and see what happens when we can remove them. But, you know, that all hinges on cooperation from farmers and being able to find more of these livestock carcass dumps out on the landscape.
Tyler, thank you so much for being able to join us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Tyler Petrulia is a wildlife researcher and doctoral candidate at Mississippi State University. His research was recently featured in a piece at wiscontext.org.
The nicer weather appears to be here to stay, and a lot of bicyclists are coming out of hibernation. May is National Bike Safety Month, and our next guest has advice on how to have enjoyable and safe bike rides around Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you new to biking or thinking about trying more biking this summer? What are your worries or questions? And if you're a more experienced biker, what are some things you wish you knew when you first started biking? You can give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
Carolyn Dvorak is the Southwest Region Director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed. She's based in La Crosse. Carolyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the safety, have you been taking advantage of this weather yourself and getting out and biking?
I have. I enjoy bicycling, and I actually bicycle year-round.
And, you know, we are in the summer months. We are in the Bike Safety Month. So what is biking like for Wisconsin bicyclists?
Oh, Wisconsin is a great place to ride a bike. And we work really hard all across Wisconsin to make our communities safe and comfortable to ride. We have great paved roads all across Wisconsin. And we have lots of trails, linear trails and mountain bike trails, communities that are working really hard to have connections and bike lanes to make people comfortable to ride a bike.
And you know, there's a lot of arguments sometimes between bicyclists and motorists about, you know, who's hogging the road. And I assume there's good advice for both sides. Let's start with the bicyclists themselves. And let's start maybe on that that rural ride, a county road, things like that. What are some of the key safety elements that the cyclist should be looking out for?
Right. So whether you ride a bike on the rural road or in the city, really two of the most important things to do are to be visible and be predictable. So you really want to ride in the lane 3 feet from the side of the road, or if you're in the city, 3 feet from parked cars. That way, motorists will see you when you're riding your bike. And you also want to be predictable. And that means riding in a straight line, stopping for all stop signs and signal lights, never weaving in and out of parked cars, and making sure you're in the rightmost travel lane for the destination you want to travel. If you're riding at night, of course, you must make sure to have a front white light and a rear red reflector or a red blinking light.
Are there any misconceptions, as Rob was alluding to, that there's sometimes bicyclists who get angry or motorists that get angry, some misconceptions about how, you know, cars should be interacting with bicyclists on the road?
Yeah, so it is true that lots of times motorists are impatient with cyclists. I think if cyclists are in the lane, that they're really interfering with their travel. But really, roads are shared space, and we all have the right to use the space. So when you see somebody riding in the lane, they're really riding in the safe place, and you might, as a driver of a car, have to slow down and wait for oncoming traffic to pass before you move into the other lane and give 3 feet to pass. So really, it's just a matter of being patient, respecting all other road users, and be sure to share the space on the road.
You are in the western part of the state, a lovely part of the state to bike or drive or hike, but there can be some visibility issues, windy roads going around bluffs and things like that. Are there special challenges, things to watch out for motorists and bicyclists?
Yeah, so the most important thing to do when you're driving is to make sure that you always have your car under control. So it's true, the Cooley region is beautiful with lots of big hills and curving roads, and it's fun to be on a Sunday drive, but it's also really fun to be on a Sunday ride on your bike. And so I always tell cyclists that the most comfortable roads to ride on are the county roads, the lettered roads, the state highway, the numbered roads have more traffic, but we're all have the ability to use both roads. So if drivers just make sure that they are driving slowly enough, paying attention, so that if somebody would come into their sight line, that they have the ability to slow down, move over, and control their car, then everybody will get to where they want to go safely. And the same thing goes for cyclists. A cyclist descending a hill can really move at quite a fast speed. It could be 45 miles per hour, maybe even faster if it's a really great hill. But the cyclist too must make sure that they control their bike, which would really mean staying in the correct lane, never crossing over the yellow line, and being in the lane of oncoming traffic. So as long as everybody respects other road users, then we can all really make sure that we get to where we're going and enjoy the great Wisconsin roads.
We are talking to Carolyn Dvorak. She is the Southwest Region Director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed based in La Crosse. And we were just talking about the winding roads that southwestern Wisconsin has. But a lot of our listeners might live in cities or towns where they're going to be in closer proximity to cars. They might be commuting a little bit more. You know, what should they be on the lookout for to maintain a safe ride?
Yeah, so riding in communities, oftentimes people choose to ride their bike rather than drive a car. La Crosse is a great example. It's a really great community. It's sort of built on a grid system tucked in between the river and the bluffs. And the city, believe it or not, is very flat. Everything is very close together. So it is really often much more convenient to ride a bike than to drive a car. As a matter of fact, we have about 3.3% of all La Crosse residents choose to commute by bike, which is really 4 times the national average. So the best thing to do when you're riding on a bike is really the same thing that you do when you're driving a car. Just follow all traffic laws, ride in the right lane, be visible and predictable, follow all traffic laws, and be sure that you're sharing the road with others. When we're riding bikes and we come to an intersection and a person is walking across the street, we have to yield to people walking across the street, just as drivers must yield to people walking.
It's Bike Safety Month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your biggest worry if you're a bicyclist, wherever you're riding? What is your biggest safety concern out on the road? What questions do you have for our guest? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carolyn, you said you ride your bike year-round. How about for those seasonal bicyclists who are maybe just starting to think, oh yeah, this is the weather's great, finally, I want to get out there. What are the sort of maintenance basics that people should be looking at at if they're pulling the bike out of the garage for the first time.
Yeah, well, I guess really the first thing to do is check the tires and pump them up, make sure they're full of air. That helps to prevent flats. And then make sure that your chain has oil on it, your brakes are working, your pedals are on tight. And really, we should do that every time we ride, just to make sure that our ride is more efficient and we don't get stuck someplace. But once your bike is ready to go, then riding a bike, any bike, is really just such a fun way to get around. It's great for recreation. It's great for exercise. It's a great way to socialize. Even if you have errands to do at the end of a work day, it's just so much more pleasant to hop on a bike to do a few things rather than to jump in a car.
And it is getting nice out. We are in that seasonal time. And it's not just grown-ups who are on the roads or on the sidewalks biking. It's also kids. What advice do you have for any of the kids out there listening to be safe on their bikes, or for their parents who are also probably listening?
Yeah, so really parents are the best judge of when kids are ready to ride on the street and ride on their own. We generally say about 10 is a time when kids are ready to start riding in the street, but really parents are the best at knowing when the time is right. We also really recommend that parents ride with kids. They're the best models of safety, and that's how kids learn, is riding with others, watching people ride correctly. Of course, it's great to find classes for kids to teach, you know, how to interact in traffic. And we also know that learning to ride a bike is developmental. So not only once you learn to balance a bike, you have to learn to know when to properly judge how to cross an intersection, learn to look where cars may come from. And all that takes lots of practice. So the best thing parents can do is model good behavior and ride with their kids often.
And JC reminded me, sidewalks, there are laws about who mm-hmm. and when you can ride on sidewalks. I will say, based on my personal observation, opinions vary for the bicyclist on the street and the pedestrian on the street. What's the deal with sidewalks and biking?
Well, every community has the ability to create their own ordinances. We know that lots of people teach their kids to ride on the sidewalk. But really, we know that as we get older, that the streets are the safer place to be, because drivers are not looking for people on sidewalks, and cars are intersecting sidewalks at alleys, intersections, driveways, parking lots, and they really forget to look for who may be crossing their path on the sidewalk. So if people do choose to ride on the sidewalk and it's a legal movement, then we really recommend watching assuming that the driver will not be watching for you. But we really once again recommend that check your city ordinances to see where it's legal, and know that the safest place to ride is in the road, where drivers will watch for who is traveling in the lane.
We heard from a Rich in Stevens Point. Not time to take your call. Sorry, Rich, but to sum up, he got hit by a car as a full season commuter. He says drivers should stay off their phones. Probably a rule that could apply to drivers, Carolyn, and people riding the bikes for that matter.
Right. So really, when we're on our roads, we need to avoid all distractions, because we're a part of traffic, whether we're walking, riding a bike, or driving. And it's really serious business. So we really do need to avoid all distractions. So put away not only our phones, but any kind of electronic devices while we're traveling. Although it's not illegal on your bike to listen with headphones or all of those things, the best advice is to really give your full attention to driving and riding a bike.
Carolyn, really quickly, we only have about 30 seconds left. Do you have any bike trips planned for the summer?
Well, I always participate in the Scenic Shore 150 ride, which is up the shore of Lake Michigan. That's a beautiful ride. And so for the moment, that's the only trip I have planned. I love to ride on the trails. I love to take rides on the rural roads whenever I have the opportunity. And I really just love to get around on a bike.
Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today. Carolyn Dvorak is the Southwest Region Director of the Wisconsin Bike Fed based in La Crosse. She joined us to talk about Bike Safety Month.
And you can let us know your favorite place to go biking. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's good news, bad news for the city of Lake Worth, Florida. Good news, they're not being overrun by zombies. Bad news, they may have thought they were.
The city sent out a cell phone alert to residents to warn of a power outage at 1:41 in the morning on Monday, but maybe thanks to an inside joke, the message included a zombie warning.
Here's the message people got on their phones. Power outage and zombie alert for residents of Lake Worth and Terminus. There are now far less than 7,380 customers involved due to extreme zombie activity. Restoration time uncertain.
It should be noted that Terminus is not in the Lake Worth area. It's a city in the zombie TV show The Walking Dead.
Now, suppose you get this cell phone alert. Now, if I got it at, I don't know, in the afternoon, I'm wide awake. I say, oh, whoops, haha, silly zombie alert. If my phone started buzzing at 1:40 in the morning and I'm sort of half awake and bleary-eyed mid-dream.
I think I would wake up and be like, oh my gosh, what is happening? Probably
and the power's
roll out of bed.
The power is out, so you're prepared for the zombie attack.
To throw you off.
All's well that ends well. Again, the town is, as I understand it, completely zombie-free.
Yep.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.